92nd episode of Reverse Rob Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 110 years to the day that Northamptonshire was skittled for just 12 in 40 minutes by Gloucestershire. It remains the lowest score in county cricket history. Welcome to the podcast that is always looking to push the boundaries of ineptitude.
What's a marvel for me is how on earth they actually managed to take 40 minutes to score 12 runs. One of the things we do particularly well on this podcast is to rattle through our ineptitude at particularly quick pace. And over the next half an hour or so, we're going to be talking about things that have been happening recently, the good old Champions Trophy, and some of the interesting things that have come out of that. Andy, you've been having your eye on some resignation letters that have been coming out of India, particularly niche, but there you go, someone's got to do it. I'm going to be talking about the history of streaking, of all things. Now, if ever there was a line that was going to keep you listening for the next 10 minutes, it's going to be that. And also, we've been watching a wonderful film called A Bat, A Ball and A Boy. So since we last recorded, Andy, you've been actually keeping an eye as well on some building developments in South London.
Yes, so it's been a week of announcements for big cricket stadium development in England. Earlier in the week came the announcement that Lords have put to their members a big new redevelopment plan. And then hot on the heels of that came the news that the Oval, by 2023, expects to be the biggest ground in England. So expansion work that would take it up to 40,000 in capacity. The plans look awesome. I mean, I'm kind of worried because you often get these artist impression drawings that are way more wonderful than the final product.
And the crowd is all behaving. There are no beer snakes or anything. Everyone's sitting there applauding politely. But yet we know that's all a fable.
But while we're going to be, you know, we'll try and remain glass very much half full about this, it does look brilliant. They've managed to keep the very sort of the historic aspect of the design is still there. They've managed to keep the legendary gas tower, at least to some extent. And I think, you know, it's one thing I've banged on about quite often in this podcast. One problem we really have in England, compared to Australia, compared to India, is our top grounds are just too small. And it means that for the big games, you know, basic economic supply and demand, the ticket prices end up, I think, often being really, really silly because of that. So I think it's great to see as a development. And I think it's quite a ringing endorsement, actually, of the health of the game. I mean, the Surrey are able to say that actually they're selling out so many games, not just international, but domestic, that this makes sense for them. I think the only drawback, if you can find one, is that this is all very indicative of the sort of London and the rest spread. You've got Lords piling money into their development. You've got Surrey piling money into theirs. And you can imagine that a lot of the other counties, and I'm not, you know, talking about the small ones, you know, big counties, Yorkshire, Lancashire, and co, will be looking on at this pretty enviously.
Well, and also the other issue is that when you have a big stadium of that size, you have a pressure to fill it. And therefore, does it then play more into the hands of putting on more and more 2020 games where you know you can get a significant audience that will come out for a you know, Friday evening game or something like that. I mean, do we know what ground is the biggest in the UK at the moment? I would have thought it was the Oval anyway.
No, Lords.
But I can't
Lords,
imagine that.
Lords really? Is bigger. Yeah, Lords is bigger than the Oval at present, but
because,
it will
because
be.
Because Lords is only kind of 28,000 or something. I say that completely off the top of my head.
Yeah.
No,
that's
never happened,
but
like
I think this is part of the issue. I mean, I think, you know, and as you would know from Australia, where you've got grounds that can hold sort of 80,000 plus.
We've got biggies down here. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
the good old MCG that seats 110,000 or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think the trick will be, can you keep that ground atmosphere in a stadium? Because for all of us who visited big stadiums, they do feel different to a ground.
They do.
And I think that will be the challenge. Can you build up to 40,000 and still keep it as a ground? Now, talking about these sort of great English stadiums, the Champions Trophy has been taking place in these this week, at least when the weather has stayed away, and you've been enjoying it.
I have been enjoying it. So actually, there's something about, obviously, Australian time zones down here in Sydney. You have to watch most of it in the middle of the night, and mostly I wake up in the morning, you know, and the first thing I do is check what on earth has gone wrong for England now. But obviously, it's been quite successful from an English point of view. But the other thing that's been quite successful in this tournament is some of the smaller teams actually coming out on top, and particularly Bangladesh beating New Zealand, you know, a really solid New Zealand side. And I think we can now regard New Zealand as one of the really the A teams, particularly in one day cricket. And Bangladesh coming out and beating them, this remarkable game where they, you know, New Zealand set a really solid total. Bangladesh really faltered, lost some very early wickets chasing it. And then particularly Shakib Al Hassan coming out and scoring an astonishing century. And what's great is that, you know, I've often thought that these one day tournaments, what are they good for? One of the only things really that they're good for is making, you know, giving a platform to some of the smaller teams to really come out and show their stuff on the international stage.
Favourite part of that game was the wonderful stumping of Jimmy Neesham. It was so out of club cricket. Yeah. It was kind of awful half-track spinner, and Neesham danced down the wicket, missed it by about half a foot and was stumped. It was wonderful to see.
We've all been there. And the other thing is that even outside the Champions Trophy, Afghanistan beating the West Indies the other day as well was fantastic in that three-match ODI series that Afghanistan are playing against the West Indies as well.
What was really encouraging about that is we are trying to experiment, I think, as a game with more and more associates versus first-class member cricket. And I think that represents, if you can get a semi-competitive series between Afghanistan and West Indies, it makes you think, well, yeah, we should try more series like this.
Absolutely. Now, tell me, so I was giving recently, some talks about the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, and one of the things I was talking about was that in 1717, I think it was, he wrote a resignation letter that was received so badly by his employer that he got thrown in jail for it. And during these talks, I was saying, has anyone ever resigned so badly as that? But I think you've got a resignation story. That's a long-winded way to introduce this, but I think you've got a resignation story as well that is along those lines, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's I mean, in some ways you can read this as a depressing or an uplifting event, but for those of you who don't follow the minutiae of Indian Cricket Administration, earlier this year, India's Supreme Court appointed a four-man committee of administrators to basically oversee the BCCI and encourage reform. And it, at the time, it was greeted as a very positive step. And one of the members of that committee was Ramachandran Guha, who I had the pleasure to see speak in an event last year, and he was wonderful. He's a historian and cricket lover, thoughtful, funny, and clearly completely cricket-mad. But after just a few months in the role, he's resigned, basically because he doesn't feel like they're making any progress. And his letter, his resignation letter, is a damning indictment of the game in India. And I strongly suggest you read it. It's, you know, will be a useful 2 minutes of your time. I'll just pick up on a couple of points. He talks about the blatant conflicts of interest within the Indian game that he doesn't believe would be allowed in any other country. Particularly, he focuses on the issue of BCCI contracted commentators like Sunil Gavaskar, who also act as player agents. So you have this extraordinary situation where the commentator is supposed to be talking neutrally. You know, so these are this was one issue, but he particularly becomes, I think, very strongly passionate about the issue of superstar syndrome, and how this has distorted the system of India, the way contracts are given out for the international team. So he's particularly infuriated by the fact that Dhoni, despite having said he will play no more Test cricket, was still awarded the A-class top-level contract. And he just said there is a reluctance in the game to look at players, to some extent, as players, but to look at them as celebrities. And I think, in a sense, the thing you can be optimistic about is it shows that if you get clever cricket lovers involved in the administration of the game, they will at least identify these problems and speak up about them.
But will it make a difference?
Well,
I mean,
exactly.
He's spoken up about them after having resigned. So it's, you know, it, in a sense, presumably more helpful to do this while you're actually in the job and have a power to actually change things.
Agreed. And sadly, I think his resignation reflects the fact. And let's be honest, this is not, you know, this whole, you know, not throwing stones while we're in a glass house. Some of these problems are not unique to the Indian game. And there is this issue here of entrenched interests that exist, I think, within the administrations of almost all the Test nations. Yeah. Yes, you on a more
on a less highfalutin
on a
front,
less on a less highfalutin note, you've been focusing on facial hair.
Yeah, so last night I was actually out at my my girlfriend's father's 65th birthday party, which was not quite as raucous as I'd hoped. And I, you know, we got back into somewhere in a western suburb of Sydney, and we got back into the city at about 10 o'clock. And I decided I wanted to go and see a bit of the England and Australia game. Australia were just finishing their innings, and so I went, took myself off to a pub, and I sat there and I had a couple of beers, and I looked particularly at Joe Root sitting on the playing there, and I was looking particularly at his chin, and I was thinking to myself, you know, that for a long time I've harboured this view that I would eventually graduate. You know, I'm shit at cricket fundamentally, but I've always harboured this view that I would actually graduate one day to grow up to be a cricketer that would have a chance of actually playing for England, or at least for one of the county sides, you know, and occasionally having a pop at a game for England. And I suddenly saw Joe Root, you know, probably the finest batsman England has produced in a long while, captaining England, and he doesn't have a spot of facial hair. And I suddenly realised how much younger he was than me, and therefore how hopeless my views of ever playing for England were.
I
And so
think.
there I was sitting, you know, having this revelation in a Sydney pub on a Saturday afternoon, and it was a bit sort of crestfallen, really.
You almost need a list for these things. So gradually, as you get older, there are people in the public eye who are now suddenly younger than you. And in Joe Root is the first England cricket captain to be younger than I was and we were when appointed. And I think this just gets worse from now. You know, I think the next step is when the Chancellor of the Exchequer is younger than you, and then the Prime Minister, you know, and then just generally it'll get worse and worse and worse. So yes, lots to look forward to there. From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to take us through the history of streaking, a cricketing institution that has remained strong despite the authorities' constant attempts to root it out.
So it's the 4th of August 1975, and Michelangelo is sitting in the stands at Lord's. Now, this isn't Michelangelo, the Italian artist and sculptor, but Michael space Angelo with a W on the end. And good old Mr. Angelo has had a few cans of Australian lager. He did actually, in later reports of the incident, pinpoint that the lager was Australian. He wanted everyone to know that. And what he does is he decides, after having had a few lagers, he decides that he's going to take all his clothes off and he's going to run across the pitch. And the picture of Angelo hurdling the stumps has become absolutely iconic. It was featured on an album cover recently, and it's that classic black and white photo of a man straddling the stumps, his hands kind of between his legs in a bit of a V for victory sign. And he was the man who started the tradition of streaking at the cricket. Now, Angelo wasn't really a professional streaker. He was a cricket lover who had just on that day happened to drink too much. And actually, what's interesting is that he waited until the end of Dennis Lilly's over. Dennis Lilly was bowling at that point. He waited until the end of the over to streak because actually he didn't want to disturb the game. He said, "I'm a true cricket fan, but I do not want to disturb the game." And actually, when the magistrate came to fine him for public indecency after the game, the magistrate actually fined him just £10, saying that clearly, you know, you're not a serial offender in this case. This is just a bit of mischief, really. And actually, that £10, ironically, was exactly the same amount as his friends had bet him that he wouldn't go and streak. And so he ended up actually money neutral from the whole episode.
Now, this is a rather good indication of how things have changed because if you go to pretty much any major English cricket ground now, there are big signs up reminding you of the level of fine for entering the field of play inappropriately. And I can tell you that you would not be getting off with £10. I think sort of you could be paying well over £1,000, which means your friends would have had to bet you know, it would have to be a very generous wager to make that financially viable.
Exactly, but there's also a real change of attitude, definitely around streaking. But in interestingly, one of the most recent examples of streaking was in 2016, when an Australian called Alex James streaks during the rain break of a Sri Lanka-Australia test match in Sri Lanka. Now, he was fined £15, just £15 in money, but he was also ordered to spend a week in jail, which, arguably is obviously the bigger punishment of the two. What was great about good old Alex James just a couple of years ago was that he was a particularly kind of mild offender. He ran onto the pitch, ran around naked for a little while. No one really wanted to chase him because it was a bit kind of wet and, cold out there. He ran back into the stands when he realized that no one was chasing him, put his clothes on, and it was only when he was fully clothed that someone arrested him. But really, our friend Michelangelo was the guy who really started the cult of streaking in a significant way. And actually, after he'd done that, he was offered a number of lucrative deals to star in pornographic films, as well as people offering him cash to go and streak at other sporting events, including at Ascot and other places. But good old Michael, he decided that actually the life that he really wanted to lead was in the kitchen of a merchant navy ship, and that's what he went off and did for the rest of his
That's
life. And
also,
really, for him, this was just a one-off thing.
yes, he's also encapsulating the good old amateur professional divide in cricket, isn't it? It's okay to be an amateur streaker, but by the time you're going pro, there's something a little bit unseemly about it.
Well, exactly. And certainly one person who thought that the idea of streaking going pro was a bit of a danger was Greg Chappell, the Australian captain. And he was the Australian captain on this day in 1975 when Michelangelo first streaked. And Greg Chappell, he was usually a pretty laissez-faire kind of guy, suddenly decided that this was the beginning of the end, that if people were going to start streaking, that he just didn't want to have any more to do with the game. And so Greg Chappell kind of waged an amusing one-man war on streakers. And whenever a streaker would run onto the pitch when Greg Chappell was playing, either as batsman or in the field, he would take it upon himself to reprimand them and kind of act the part of the policing. Because often the police who were at the grounds were often, actually the people who were not considered fit for street duty, and so were not particularly, healthy and couldn't run around and chase people. It was actually left up to the cricketers to catch these streakers. And so Greg Chappell develops this reputation for running after the streakers and then also smacking them on the bottom, on their bare bottoms, in order to sort of, punish them.
My
And there was.
worry it with that is that if you develop a reputation as being the kind of streaker enforcer, then you know as a streaker at a game that Greg Chappell's at that you're guaranteed some attention, which I feel like rather destroys the whole point, doesn't it? If you're if you're trying to discourage these attention-seeking people, saying that I, the Australian captain, will chase you and make a big incident of this possibly isn't the best way
Exactly,
to go.
exactly. And those were always the photos that ended up all over the newspaper. So there's a wonderful photo of Greg Chappell grasping a young gentleman who was wearing nothing other than his hair, let's say, grasping him by the hair and holding him there until the police came along. Actually, that was the incident that actually changed a lot of attitudes towards streaking, because when Chappell was holding him by the hair, he decided with his spare hand, he was batting at that time, Chappell was, and he decided with his spare hand that was holding the bat that he'd give this young gentleman a bit of a wrap around the buttocks with his bat. And nothing particularly, malicious, nothing more than a briefly stinging blow. But this streaker decided that he was actually going to press criminal charges against Chappell for having done this, for assault. And it was these charges were eventually dismissed. But at that point, the cricket administrators identified this as a bit of a problem, and actually said that the cricketers should not get involved with actually reprimanding the streakers, and they should leave it to the police. That they should leave it to the police as well.
Because often part of the fun in these incidents is the sort of Benny Hill chase scene with the police or stewards desperately. What you really want is
Oh,
a
they're
quick, nimble
fantastic.
streaker and a couple of really fat stewards. And that's, as a crowd, that's maximum entertainment guaranteed.
It is absolute entertainment, and it hasn't actually stopped cricketers from getting involved with stopping those streakers. In 2008, that infamous incident with Andrew Symonds, the Australian all-rounder, who absolutely floored a streaker with his shoulder, sort of shoulder bars to him. A guy called Robert Ogilvie made the mistake of getting too close to Simons. And what was
I think
interesting
that
after
suggests a
that?
lack of cricketing knowledge, because if I was if I had had
You wouldn't
too
go
many
anywhere near
Australian overs,
Simons, would you?
he would be the one I'd avoid. It's a bit like
No,
if I was
absolutely.
streaking in a current England game, I'd probably Mark Wood fine, Joe Root fine. I wouldn't go anywhere near Ben Stokes.
Ben Stokes would not be the person you would go anywhere near. Absolutely. And what? But what was interesting is that this. So this is in 2008, and we live in a particularly litigious age. But Andrew Symons got away with not even so much as a reprimand from Cricket Australia, whereas Ogilvie was fined quite significantly for encroaching on the pitch. And that's exactly, going back to what you were just saying, something that has changed is that nowadays we have a set of rules whereby people are just completely prohibited from going anywhere near the pitch. So it's not so much the streaking that's the problem, it's actually going on the pitch that is the problem. Now, the other thing about streaking is that you can actually make quite a name for yourself out of it. It's actually pretty fantastic publicity. And one of my favourite streaks was Sheila Nicholls, who was a British woman who streaked at Lord's in 1989. And there's actually footage of this on YouTube, which I would recommend watching simply for the sheer exuberance that she shows when she's running around Lord's completely naked, her hands above her head, just clearly loving the experience of leading these security guards on a kind of merry chase. But the other thing about Sheila Nicholls is that she's a pop singer. And she and her band's The Splendid Frock, and maybe that frock was the frock that she took off before she went and streaked on the ground at Lord's, actually went on to have a very successful career, particularly in the US. And I do wonder whether there's something about full frontal nudity and success in the pop world that actually can correlate one with the other.
And I think these people like good old Sheila, they were still trendsetters and taboo breakers. I think now when people do it, they're following in a long tradition, aren't they? It's not quite as radical an act.
Exactly, and I think that there's something about that breaking taboos that makes it particularly significant about streaking at Lord's. Lord's has become the home of streaking simply because Lord's is the home of the institution and it's the home of tradition. And therefore, to streak at Lord's is much, much more significant than to streak anywhere else, because that thing of taking all your clothes off, you're somehow offending some ancient tradition of the game doing it at Lord's more than you are
It's odd,
anywhere
Toby,
else.
that I've never heard the MCC refer to Lords as the home of streaking, and I'm not sure they would be thrilled by that as a name.
I think they should rebrand.
There's been all these efforts via TV coverage, certainly, to get rid of the attention-seeking aspect of it. So if streaking happens now, the TV cameras will whisk away and they'll look at something else, and you'll think, why am I?
Prudish.
Yes, exactly. You'll be thinking, why am I getting footage of Joe Root hanging out at mid-on? Because that just happens to be where the streaker isn't. But I guess the problem you've got with that is you still just need for it to be. The crowd is still enough, isn't it? I think for most attention-seeking people, even if you're not going to be there for the millions on television, you've still got a very, well, a very captive audience.
Absolutely. So Karen Jackson, who runs a wonderful website called Streakorama, I spent a lot of this morning reading Streakorama, and my girlfriend's internet usage is now completely used up with Streakorama. When the police come, they'll come for her first. Identified the fact that it's actually streaking is about two things. It's about reducing inhibitions due to alcohol. A lot of people who streak, frankly, have been drinking quite a lot. But it's also because of the adrenaline rush of that taboo and of that going out in front of a whole lot of people and doing something that is against our societal norms. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, that's only a thing that's to be encouraged. So to the review, and for this episode, we have been watching a film this time called A Bat, A Ball and A Boy. You can find it on the Lord's YouTube channel, and it was made about half a century ago, and it's a documentary about a boy being trained by a remarkable number of Australian cricketing greats in various facets of the game. Now, Andy, this is essentially a film that is intended for the information of the people watching it, for the education of the people watching it. What did you learn from it?
Well, I think one of the most
As a
interesting,
cricketer.
as a cricketer, well, that's a great question. So if I was a young aspiring cricketer, what lesson would I have taken away?
Yeah.
Richie Beno, at one point in the film, justifies the fact that he does not have a straight back lift. And he says if any coach had got to work on him early in his career, they would have straightened his back lift, and they think this would be a mistake. And this actually is something that when I've had coaching sessions, I've been often told, oh, your back lift must be straighter, your back lift must be straighter. So I thought it was nice to have Richie Beno on my side. I think other than.
Justification for bad habits
Well,
is always satisfying in many ways.
exactly. I think other than that, I very, very much enjoyed the comparison of the different bowlers' run-ups. Now, as a well, we won't get into talking about my bowling. I'm not sure if I really learned a huge amount that I could apply, but I think it was very interesting talking about sort of respectively how attractive the different run-ups were. And the narrator was actually pretty damning of some. He was, I think, with one bowler, he was like, "Oh, it's a bit like a craftsman or tradesman rather than an artist." And then with Ray Lindwall, you know, he was talking about Ray Lindwall's action in the same way other, you know, others would talk about the great wonders of the world. You know, it was being described as a true thing of beauty. So I quite enjoyed those comparisons. Now, you also in this film get to watch, as you said, a lot of Australian greats in action. Did any make a particular impression on you?
It's one of the slightly ludicrous things about it that it's so basically the narrative of the film is that there's a boy called, what's he called? He's called Fred or
Jeff.
Jeff, that's it. Good old
Whatever
Jeff.
happened to Jeff as well? That's what I wanted to know.
I know.
Whatever
He's
happened to
actually
Jeff?
now Alistair Cook in disguise. But
Wow.
this is so good old Jeff, and he's batting in the nets, and he's kind of got it all a bit wrong. And Richie Beno happens to be there and kind of wanders up and says, No, that's not how you do it. Why don't you come and see my mate Arthur Miller, who just happens to be milling around on the other side of the ground, and we'll, get him to teach you how to do whatever. And suddenly, and then there's Ray Lindwall, and there's a whole sort of panoply of greats who suddenly Jeff gets the benefit of their education. And one of the things I thought was quite interesting was when you watch it now, and well, this film must have been, what we haven't been able to exactly work out when this film was made, but we think, it must have been, what, 40 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, easily.
And one of the things that's quite interesting is just watching the attitude towards how you coach people and how you teach people, because what's kind of quite uncomfortable about watching it is our friend Jeff, who Richie Beno just, whenever Jeff tries to do anything, Beno just says, no, come on, that's wrong, that's not how you do it, that's not how you do it. And actually, for all of the talk that there is in the film about, follow your natural style and everything like that, actually it does follow that kind of prescriptive old MCC cricket book approach to training young people.
Yes, because actually interspersed within these coaching sessions and displays of these Australian greats playing the game, there's an interview that Benno does with Bradman, and one of the things the Don says is, you know, it's very, very important not to interfere with natural ability. And he talks about the fact that one of the best players he ever saw or played against was Jack Hobbs, and he said Jack Hobbs was fascinating because he was the most technically correct player Bradman ever played with, but was basically uncoached.
Untrained, yeah.
One thing you get, and is a bit of a pleasure, although frankly, after about the 15th replay, it's starting to get a little bit, you know, it's one for the cricketing purists, are these slow-mo replays of these Australian greats. And it reminds you, I mean, today we're all very comfortable with the fact that slow motion is at the heart of cricket TV coverage and allows us a really new insight to the game. And you can see at this time how excited they were with this new toy. I mean, how much fun is it to watch Keith Miller driving the ball in slow-mo? I mean, dancing down the wicket to spinners, watching that foot movement. It's great to watch, but as I say, they possibly get slightly carried away, I think, by the
Well,
sort
it's
of
also
100th
that
replay.
technology. Remember when we were reviewing that book of about Victor Trumper by Gideon Hay? That whole thing of when you had to see cricketers up close, you couldn't actually do it from the boundary in a genuine situation. You had to contrive a situation, and so you had to actually, create a. So this is the moment where they're featuring one of the bowlers about to run up, and they say, "Here he is standing at the top of his marker," when he adjusts the field, and clearly there are no fielders anywhere around. The whole thing is completely fabricated, and that's the only way they could actually get close enough in order to feature any of the players. But I think it's an ongoing, factor of the film, the fact that the cricketers are called upon to be actors, and some of them are more natural actors than other ones. I think it's fair to say that, isn't it?
Well, You know, now when you do any documentary, there are a lot of even modern day documentaries are staged to some extent. There's this real emphasis on making it as real as possible. They don't really bother with that here. In the intro sequence, there's this lovely thing where our man Jeff is playing with some of his mates, and Ray Windwall just sort of happens to walk past, and the whole thing is so wonderfully staged that it is kind of lovable. But I think there are some, lots of moments where you're like, how much has cricket changed? And one of my favourites is the bowling machine, and it is a real Heath Robinson-esque contraption with a propeller that looks like it would be capable of sort of taking off.
Oh, absolutely. If I was the person putting the balls into that, I'd be absolutely terrified that they were just going to come straight back at me.
But for reasons that are completely unclear, rather than just having a normal person operate the bowling machine, they get some slight mad scientists in a white coat to feed
In
the
a white
balls in,
coat, yeah.
completely unnecessarily. So I think that's very entertaining. I would love, by the way, on your subject of, how they tried to set these situations up, I would love to have watched a making of this film, because I imagine that for just one of the run-out sequences, presumably you had to run that about 40 times until you finally got what you wanted to happen, and
Yeah,
actually managed to get
absolutely.
it all correct.
Absolutely.
I think I was trying to think how much fun it would be, but how different it would be to sort of have a modern version of this. Do you know what I mean? If you got sort of the current England squad or whatever to do a kind of, we're going to teach a modern day Jeff how to play the game. I
Well,
actually think that would be great
they
fun.
did do the ECB did a kind of video diary from the Ashes a few years ago where they did videos from the nets and stuff,
Ah,
exactly talking
okay.
about, oh, what's Owen Morgan training on today, training on how to not be able to bat like a test batsman. But I think that the reason why that just didn't get any real traction. Well, I don't know why that didn't get any traction, but I know that they stopped it because no one was really interested, I think. Whereas I think back in the day, this view, being able to get this glimpse of your stars was quite important in a way. There was a different level of access that you could get to the superstars of the cricket world. And certainly, what's interesting is that this film was actually sponsored by Coca-Cola, and so clearly Coca-Cola decided that this was going to be something that would be mass market enough and presumably shown in enough cinemas to really get their brand out there, and that what is, as you say, a pretty dense cricket coaching film would actually have enough of a mass market appeal.
Yes, the product placement is actually, well, at least maybe I was not paying attention fully, but I thought was surprisingly subtle. There's just a moment near the end where Richie Beno picks up a refreshing Coke. There's also a very bizarre final sequence where, apropos of nothing else in the film, we're taken on a brief world tour to see different places in the world that cricket is played. I think the message being that if young Jeff ever wants to sort of, travel the world and
He
be
can take over the
successful,
world.
yes.
Absolutely.
But as I said, this is really what we need to find out. Whatever happened to young Jeff? So if you do want to watch the film, I'll stick the link up in the on the podcast page, and yeah, it's of an entertaining 40 minutes of well, of cricketing history.
Remember that you can be Jeff too. So that's a bat, a ball, and a boy, which can be found on the Lords YouTube channel. So if you just search bat, ball, boy, Lords, I assume that it'll come up on YouTube. Thank you for listening to the,
90
what is that now?
seconds.
92nd. We're firmly in the nervous 90s. 92nd episode of Reverse Web Radio. We'll be back in a few weeks' time. As ever, we love hearing from you over on the old Twitter. At Reverse Swept is our hashtag handle or whatever it's called. So please do find us over there. And we'll look forward to talking to you again in a few weeks' time.